For those of you that don't know me, my name is Mark Hayes. I'm a research scientist with who is not in the fish program. That would be the habitat program. And I'm going to talk to you about the other species. Just to let you know, the key folks working with me on this are Julie Tyson and Keith DeVille, who are also in the crowd here, but I'd like to also call out all the support that we have for this study. We sampled 187 sites in the Chehalis floodplain that you would term off channel habitats of one kind or another. And this ranges from oxbows and off side channels and various other things. And because 70% of the floodplain is privately owned, we had to ask permission from individual owners for almost the entire suite except for the publicly owned ones, and we had an 80% success rate on getting permission, which was the result of Keith's goal at the time. So basically this is a map of the Chehalis showing you the 187 or so sites that we sampled. We did this across two studies over 3 years. The two studies were partitioned temporally. One study that I'm described as the egg mass study, which is really amphibian focused, although we did also sample fishes simultaneously. And the second study, the extensive study, was a more fish focused study, and it was conducted from late spring to late summer. So the egg mass study was a late winter enterprise. And we divided the Chehalis system into 10 floodplain segments. Those floodplain segments are partitioned by by major tributaries. And the next series of slides that you'll see basically show all the tributary divisions or the segments on the x-axis, ranging from your left downstream to upstream. So just take a look at the physical characteristics a little bit first. And what I'm going to do is take you through patterns. We'll use those patterns to sort of structure the background and then talk about the occupancy models and then see how the occupancy models and the background apply to guidance for restoration. And the thing that you notice basically about this graphic, on the left-hand y-axis is the area of each segment in square kilometers. The right-hand y-axis is the off-channel habitat density, or the number per kilometer squared. And what you see basically is the segment's size generally goes down as you go upstream, but the number, the off-channel unit density actually peaks in the third segment and goes up to the first segment and then more or less declines as you go upstream. Now we take a little bit different look at it based on the area of the off-channel habitat units, the OCHUs. We see a little different pattern. The area on the left is the total area off-channel habitat in each segment, whereas the area axis on the right is the mean size of the individual off-channel habitat segments. The whiskers are 95% confidence intervals. And the take-home from this is really that the size of individual off-channel habitats basically progressively decreases as you go upstream. So I'm going to take you to the biotic sub now. And a lot of graphics that you'll see are partitioned between both studies. So the egg mass study is the EMS. The EXS is the extensive study. The dots are means. The whiskers are confidence intervals. And this simply shows the number of native amphibian species or the native amphibian species richness as it varies across the floodplain. For all practical purposes, it varies very little. You get all five species from the lower end of the floodplain to the upper end. Although you do see a slight uptick in richness on the upper limit of the floodplain. If we look at abundance of native amphibians, you have more or less the same pattern. there's a lot of variation, but basically you have more or less the same mean abundance levels regardless of the sampling. And you'll notice the differential between these two studies, because the egg mass study was amphibian focused, the numbers, the means for the amphibian study, egg mass study, are generally higher than those for the extensive study. Now we're going to take you to the only exotic amphibian, and you see a very different pattern. Of course, there's only one species. We can't talk about exotic amphibian species richness. But what you see is a decrease in the proportion of occupied sites as you go to the tails of the floodplain, both the upper end and the lower end. So keep that in mind. You will see that repeated. This is the abundance index for bullfrogs. And the big difference you see here from the native amphibians is the upper tail of the floodplain. The abundance decreases sharply, just like the occupancy did. It does not so as much at the lower end. Let's go to native fish species. Native fish species show a pronounced increase as you go downstream in the floodplain. This is a pattern that has basically been seen before, and it is a fundamental link to the stream continuum concept, where you get an increase with larger stream size and more tributaries. And whether you look at it during the egg mass study in late winter, or you look at it during the summer extensive study, you get basically the same pattern. This is the abundance for native fish species. And you'll notice that native fish species show a sharp decline at the upper tail of the floodplain. But if you go to exotic fish species, you see, again, a pattern that sort of mimics what we saw with bullfrogs. So you have a sharp drop at the tails, and this is exotic species, fish species richness. And the area basically above the sapsa, which is the upper tail of the tidal surge floodplain, and the area above the south fork basically have a sharp decline. If we looked at this in more detail, the actual upper limit where it really cuts off is at Rainbow Falls, which is between the south fork and Elk Creek. And then if we look at the abundance for the same, we see that the abundance drops off at both tails of the floodplain. And then if we partition our abundance between centrarchid fishes and non-centrarchid fishes, centrarchid fishes are the spiny rayed fishes, and we had 10 exotic species that were represented in the Chao's floodplain. Six of them were centrarchids, four of them were non-centrarchids. And the thing that you see immediately is that centrarchid abundance was pronouncedly higher than that of non-centrarchid fishes. Okay, so that's the pattern. What I'd like you to take home basically from that pattern is that the native amphibians show very little difference across the length of the floodplain. Native fishes have a relatively high abundance pattern, although the richness basically increases as you go downstream. But all the exotics, both bullfrogs and the suite of warm water fishes, and by the way, all 10 exotics that we have here are warm water adapted species, show declines at the tail of the floodplain. So that leads us basically to what we did with occupancy modeling. And what we wanted to find out was, number one, the issue with exotics was a potentially important one, since there was suggestion from a lot of other information that exotics were at issue for amphibians. What I'm showing you here is the five key variables from which we have significant data for occupancy modeling. If you want to know the details of occupancy modeling, I'm not going to go through the methods. This paper was recently published in Ecosphere in 2019. It's an open access paper on which Meredith Holgerson, who led this work, was the lead. The y-axis is the occupancy probability odds ratio, and I'm not going to go into details on what the odds ratio is, but the interpretation of this is basically if you see a positive change relative to a particular variable, then that variable is responded to positively by the individual species. And we have all six amphibians, the five natives and the one exotic on here. And there are certain distinctive patterns that stick out. If you don't see a bar for certain species, it's simply because it was not outside the range of error to be recorded. And I'm going to walk you through these from left to right. So we have the presence of both exotic groups, the bullfrog and the centrarchid fishes together. And one of the interesting things that came out of this, although it had been suggested in several other studies, is that there was no negative bullfrog effect. In fact, for the two species, northern red-legged frog and northwest salamander, that we had enough of an odds ratio response to see something. We had a positive effect of bullfrogs. I'll come back to that in just a bit. What it did show, though, is a very negative effect of centrarchids for those same two species. Now you might ask, well, why didn't it show a negative effect for some of the other species? Well, the two species that it showed that strong negative effect for are the two species that had a long hydroperiod and had a long contact time with the fishes. The short hydroperiod species have relatively short contact time with the fishes, and so they have relatively little spatial overlap, and that's probably the reason that they're not there. The next one is connectivity to the main stem. With connectivity to the main stem, we broke it up into three fundamental categories, where connectivity, meaning connectivity with the main stem channel, was rare, was seasonal, in other words, it occurred regularly at least once every season, or it had some kind of permanent connectivity. And here we see a very distinctive pattern with almost all the native amphibians except rough-skinned newt. So if you take a look at the permanent connectivity category, you see a strong negative response for long-toed salamander, northern red-legged frog, northwest salamander, Pacific tree frog. And then rough-skinned newt has a positive response, which has us scratching our heads a little bit. And of course, American bullfrog, as you might expect, has a positive response. And then we have sort of a mixed bag of response depending on whether you have rare or seasonal connectivity. In the next category, with emergent vegetation, we actually had three categories of emergent vegetation, but where emergent vegetation was low, and these categories were simply one-third the percentage area covered by emergent vegetation in each of the locations. Note that in the medium category, we have a sharp positive response for the entire suite of amphibian species, although note that that response is greater for the four amphibians, except rough-skinned newt, and the bullfrog response also is not quite as great. In the high vegetation category, we have a negative response for the newt and the bullfrog, and a lesser positive response for the four native amphibians. The interpretation of this is potentially a little bit more complex, and that is that it looks like if you have sufficient emergent vegetation, it's a positive effect on the suite of amphibian species if that density of that vegetation is sort of intermediate. And that may be some kind of an effect that is linked to centrarchid presence, because we know that centrarchid presence or centrarchid, the potential for centrarchid to prey effectively is limited by vegetation density, although we don't know whether the centrarchid effect is really a predation one or it's one that acts through the food resource that may, might be eliminated by that. And then the last category, permanent hydroperiod, has to do with the hydroperiod length of individual sites, but this is strictly the permanent category. And the thing that really sticks out there is long-toed salamander, which is a very short hydroperiod species, responds negatively to the permanent hydroperiod condition. Now we know from other studies that if you looked across the hydroperiod range, you've had a truncation of where a lot of native amphibians can breed, in the sense that basically with the addition of exotic fishes, there has been less use of permanent water habitats or intermediate hydroperiod habitats that centrarchid fish may have seasonal access to. So that's the picture basically for the amphibians. And until recently, we had no information on the fishes. The next picture, or the next graphic, is the fishes. And you'll note that I only have a few of them on here because we did occupancy modeling strictly from the egg mass data where we had multiple sampling. We couldn't do it effectively from the extensive study that was single pass sampling. So it's impossible to do occupancy modeling that way. And we're still in the process of finishing this off, but Olympic mudmow and three-spined stickleback are the two species that were most abundant where we could get the most effective data out of. And I'd like you to notice a couple things. Note that with bullfrog presence and centrarchid presence, we have the parallel pattern that we did basically for the native amphibians. For connectivity, the main stem that is permanent, we have a negative pattern for both species, and both species have a positive pattern for rare and seasonal connectivity. And then for the medium emergent vegetation, we have the strongest pattern, again, like we had with the native amphibians. And for permanent hydroperiod, and of course those units that have a permanent hydroperiod for fish, for most fishes, are going to have a positive pattern. So given all that, these are the things, the key points that we have in context of guidance for restoration. There's no question that exotics are abundant in the floodplain, and notably between the Satsup and the South Fork. Centrarchid fishes have a prominent negative effect, although we don't know the nature or the mechanism for that effect. Exotic eradication is probably not an option, simply because these exotics are so widespread and the potential for recolonization is very high, and so it would be an enormously costly perpetual effort. Opportunity may exist by altering habitat to disfavor exotics. And the reason I say that is because this is one of the things that we're exploring in the planned off-channel reconnection efforts to address this opportunity. And the reason for this is that in some of the off-channel habitats that we studied intensively, we saw a thermocline develop during the summer period in which the bottom was temperature appropriate or temperature suitable for most of the cold water fisheries, but it was oxygen depleted. And the upper layer was thermally unsuitable, but oxygen depleted. And if we can change that pattern in some way by potentially increasing stage variation and increasing mixing, and also which would potentially improve the temperature profile and improve the oxygen profile, we might have an opportunity to do that. The problem is it's a very tricky situation to balance, and the size, the scale, and the local conditions of off-channel habitat have to be considered for attempting that effort. And because it is rather tricky, we've proposed an experimental approach to the thing to see what the results will be for the off-channel habitats that it might be tried for. Like I said, the Centrarchid effect looks like it might be attenuated by vegetation. One of the tricky things here is that much of the vegetation in off-channel habitats is reed canary grass. And if controlling exotics like reed canary grass becomes an important factor, it creates a conflict that is going to need some kind of careful evaluation as to how to do it. So given that, that's where we are, and I'd be happy to take any questions.